Preseason game number 2 of 3 for the Minnesota Vikings in the book. Another win. But this week is not without its difficulties, Pete. J.J. McCarthy injury, a meniscus tear. He has to get it repaired. He gets it a complete fix, so he will miss the entire season, and then hopefully be back next year. We talked a little bit about this off-air, but I think Matthew Collar, in my mind, put it best of J.J. McCarthy gave Kevin O'Connell the button to push, right? If the Sam Darnold experience is not what they hope it is, that he has that button to push. In the first preseason game of what we saw of J.J. McCarthy, and it was one preseason game against a Raiders team that, as we discussed, was terrible against the pass last year. However, he did exactly what you hoped that he would do, which is play very well and rebound from things like an interception, come out of the second half and play well. There was consistency there in his game, I think. And so everyone was very, very excited. In my mind, though, the fact that he's – and when it happened this week, when they came out and said the meniscus was torn and he was probably going to miss the season, and in my mind, other than the practice reps he was going to get, I don't know how much this necessarily hurts J.J. McCarthy's development as a quarterback and or changes how much he was truly going to play in the Vikings offense. However, yes, he's not going to get those reps. He's still going to be there. He's still going to get to learn in the film room. He's still going to absorb it all. And I think more than anything, J.J. McCarthy is going to come back very, very hungry and ready to go. And I think next year will be a phenomenal year for him. It does not bother me that he's not going to be on the field this year. I know it bothers other people. It just doesn't bother me that much because in my mind, I hope that Sam Darnold will play well enough to keep him on the sideline and learn and come out next year and be super, super hungry and ready to go.
Dave, it bothers me, but there's nothing we can do about it, right? I mean, it bothers me only because the progress that I have watched since he first got drafted by the Vikings to where he was getting to and what he looked like a guy, like we've talked about, the moment's not too big. And it makes sense, actually, because let's go back to we all know his record. His record as a high school player and a college player is just off the charts, but his Michigan performances were pretty stellar, right? I mean, across the board, it was never too big. And that's what I like so much about what he brought to the table for the Vikings. You know, the problem, and I always joke about this, as you know, about the USC quarterbacks, right? And I always say, name me a good USC quarterback. And I got it in front of me right here. Sam Darnold, 63 touchdowns, 56 interceptions. He's gone 8-10. And he's had one winning season, and that was with the Jets when he won 7, lost 6 as the starting quarterback. That's kind of the blueprint of what you see out of Matt Leinart, Sam Darnold, Matt Barkley, Mark Sanchez, John David Booty, who got drafted, didn't even play, was a practice squad guy. Sanchez has more interceptions than touchdowns. So does Barkley. So does Matt Leinart. you start going
list.
through
a great school to have that list of failed quarterbacks.
Right. And you know what it is? And it's not me being overly critical about USC, but I think you can be critical about this, which is, hey, look, USC is great. They did a great job all these years going all the way back to the 70s and 80s, right? When they have had so many great teams. But the problem is, how do you know how good the quarterback is? And it shows me that oftentimes the quarterback was not the best player. He gets all the notoriety. He gets all the press, everything. But when you look at what these guys do at the next level, at the NFL level, suddenly you say, well, maybe it was the fact that they had three guys on the offensive line that were first round draft picks.
Yeah.
And maybe a running back, probably a quarterback or a wide receiver or a tight end. Those teams were so loaded, whether it was Marcus Allen or whoever the running backs were, they had more guys that got Heisman trophies there than you can shake a stick at. And some of them were quarterbacks, but the reality was, did they even deserve them in college because of the players that they were surrounded by? You know, that's I would put a lot of those Alabama quarterbacks in this same sort of a category. They've had a little more success, but not a lot. Not all of them. So it's one of those things where, you know, what, how do you determine if they're as good as you expected them to be at the next level? Because the next level is different. And I do think when we look at this, I was curious, what did you think about the idea? You heard about the rumors and all the rest of the Tom Brady's talk and all of that.
Oh my gosh. What is he, 47 now?
He's 47 years old. And but here's the crazy part, Dave. He has kept himself in that position where people sort of wonder, he kind of sounds like maybe he's not done, right?
He
has given that to the press and everybody. I'm not saying he's gonna, but you know, JJ's a Michigan guy. Maybe Tom Brady's a Michigan guy. I mean, was there a possibility? Maybe we signed Matt Corral from the UFL, Ole Miss quarterback, but I'm not sure that's Tom Brady, right? So,
well, it's the whole, like, when Brett Favre, you know, when they signed Brett Favre for years, it was like, oh, they're going to sign Brett Favre. They're going to sign Brett Favre. I don't even know if they can afford it now, considering they just gave, you know, we talked about the Stephon Gilmore signing, gave him $10 million, number one. Number two, my guess is the reason that he's still kind of, you know, these little tidbits come out here and there. Part of it was from Colin Cowherd, who is a FS1 host, and Tom Brady is going to do football for Fox, right? I mean, you know this, Pete. It's the PR machine to keep things going. Do I want a 47-year-old Tom Brady quarterbacking the Vikings? No. Is he better than Sam Darnold? Probably.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. He probably is.
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to go he with probably yes is right now.
but there's to me, at 47 years old, there's no way that guy makes it through the season without getting injured. There's just none. But I will say this, and I fully recognize this, and I am curious if our listeners feel the same way. The 651-461-9226. It's the stylesfinancial.com talk and text line. I am fully aware that in my mind, and in terms of Viking quarterbacks, I am afraid to love again. I get it. And I have a very strong feeling that there's a lot of people out there who feel the same way. I want to fall head over heels in love with J.J. McCarthy. I absolutely do. But I have before with Tavares Jackson, with Teddy Bridgewater, with Christian Ponder. So many first round quarterback picks that were like, yep, this is the guy who's going to be next. This is the guy who's going to be next. And they never were.
Yeah.
And I don't want my heart to be broken again. So that's why I keep saying I don't want to see J.J. McCarthy yet, because I want him to be ready for this stage, both physically and mentally. Mentally, 100%. He is there, Pete. You're right. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that this injury will do nothing to his mental state. He will come back stronger than ever. The kid is a winner. The kid knows how to push himself, and he has since he was a young age, by all accounts.
Yeah.
But physically, the game speeds up. The hits are harder. The D-backs are faster. And it takes time to adjust. And I just don't want to see it. I didn't want to see him go out too early that he wasn't going to succeed, because I need this. Our hearts have been broken so many times. We need to finally have that franchise quarterback. I have been in Minnesota on and off since 2002. Been here since 2007, my second stint. What franchise quarterback have they had? I mean, Kirk Cousins, maybe. But everyone knows he couldn't win in the postseason and when the stage was the biggest. We need this guy. And we so badly need J.J. McCarthy to be him that I'm just not ready to put myself out there yet and get on the dating sites and be like, okay, I'm ready to do it. I'm just not there yet. I just don't want to have my heart broken.
So here's where I've got one question for you as far as quarterbacks, because I have an opinion. I don't know what your thoughts would be. Would there ever been a time that you would have considered Ryan Tannehill? And I understand he's had his ups and his downs, but overall, when you really look at his career, the guy's 64% completion. He's got 216 touchdowns, 115 interceptions, which basically is not bad at all. Good winning record. He's got experience in the postseason. He's always had a great running back, you know, with the big fellow back there. So what do you think? Would that have been a direction that you would have? I guess the better question would be this. Do you go for the corner to try to get things, you know, taken care of on the defensive side? Or do you worry more about the quarterback and you go for a guy like Ryan Tannehill? Could you? Could probably have afforded him. I would bet you. He's no one signed him, so I think the reality is you could probably get him for something very close to the Stephon Gilmore sort of a contract. I don't know.
Yeah, I think from their standpoint, they have bought in to Sam Darnold, right? I mean, they have no choice now. They have nothing. They can't go back and say, well, we signed Sam Darnold, but now since our rookie quarterback, who probably wasn't going to start the season, is out, let's go get another high-priced quarterback. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that works on a lot of levels. It's not that I don't think Tannehill could play, and if he's an improvement over Sam Darnold. I mean, you and I were both last year, like, how did the Vikings not get in on Joe Flacco? Who comes in and plays great for Cleveland. Mm-hmm. You know, instead they get the Pastrnak, who was good for a couple games, and then he's gone. So do I think that he would have been just as good, if not better, than Sam Darnold? Probably, but I also think that in because of the time that they're at, they have no choice but to stick with Darnold now, because you know as well as I do, Pete, that sometimes it's about egos with general managers and coaches, right? Like, they have to justify it. And Matt Collar touched on this with Lewis Cine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to justify what you've done. And there's no way in my mind that they could say, well, you know what? We swung and missed on Sam Darnold, even though he hasn't played a game yet. Or maybe what you're saying is they should have taken him over Sam Darnold. I don't know what the financials would have been. I think, to me, they're one and the same. The one thing I'll say about Darnold, and we've talked a lot about him extensively, the one thing he hasn't had in his career, and I know we got a break, is Kevin O'Connell. And yeah. I think, for my money, if there's ever been a quarterback whisperer in the NFL, it's Kevin O'Connell. And I think, now what's his ceiling? I don't know. But I think Kevin O'Connell can bring the best out of Sam Darnold. Is that good enough? We'll find out. But I think Kevin O'Connell does.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll turn our sights to the Twins. Chris Atterbury joins us coming up next. We'll talk about the Twins' chances in this last month and change of the season. You're listening to The Huddle on 830 WCCO. Chris Atterbury, the radio play-by-play voice for the Minnesota Twins, joins us now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Chris, good morning. I have not had a chance to chat with you since the start of Zebby Matthews this week. And from what I'm reading and what I saw, by all accounts, he was real impressive. What was your close-up view of how he handled himself and how he pitched?
Yeah, Zebby Mania. Let's get on with it. And it was his comportment. I think you hit how he handled it. I think that was the key. And I think that's something that we're starting to see now be endemic to the Twins player development system, that when the guys are called upon, and we've had to call upon a lot of them, they're ready mentally as well as physically. He's a really big, strong dude, and you look at him, and he's just a big block of a man. And he's got this short, quick arm stroke, and I don't think you could tell if he would have been up 10 runs, down 10 runs. He was just steady as the day is long, and he's going to have every opportunity to pitch here down the stretch, and I was impressed. And the stuff is really, really good. I mean, he just throws a ton of strikes, and if you come in and you start your first major league game and you don't walk a batter, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Chris, out of curiosity, what was your stance as far as the trade deadline? A lot of people were disappointed that we didn't do more. Were you one of those people, or do you think that we've got what it takes to get some sort of distance into the postseason?
Well, I definitely wanted to add. You always want to add pieces that can help. But I also had looked under the hood enough to know that there weren't really a lot of great options. I think the best starting pitchers were in the division. I loved Eric Fetty, but there was no way the White Sox were going to let Eric Fetty go to a team in the division. I always tell people this story. It was several years ago, and the Twins were trying to add an arm, and Nick Anderson, who's a native Minnesotan, was with Miami, and they were going nowhere. And the Twins called and said, we'd love to get Nick Anderson back. And they said, sure, give us Byron Buxton. And they said, no, well, give us Royce Lewis. No. And then a day later, they traded Nick Anderson for like Ryan Stanek and a bag of baseballs to Tampa Bay. Like, they had no problem just giving him to Tampa Bay, but with us, that wasn't going to happen. So things are weird at the trade deadline. And, you know, case in point, we're facing Tyler Mowry today for the Rangers, you know, and Twins fans might have a little, you know, trade deadline PTSD with Tyler Mowry's name, because we gave up a ton to the Reds to get him, and he was going to help, or maybe that was an off-season deal. He made so many deals with the Reds, and it just didn't work out, right? He was hurt, and he didn't get to pitch, and we watched Spencer Steer and Encarnacion Strand take off, and, you know, think about the trade deadline deal for Jorge Lopez, and they get Yennier Cano, who becomes an all-star, and Cade Povich started for the Orioles yesterday, and so it can cut both ways. We've made big swings, and we've missed, and sometimes the best swing is taking a pitch, and I think that in this case, that's probably I guess I'd rather ride with Zebby and some of the guys coming out of our system than overpay for something that I didn't think was going to move the needle. And once Carota went to Houston for the haul that they got, I mean, Houston paid through the nose for him, for a guy who I don't really think moves the needle. I think the prices went through the roof, and I think, again, I'd rather ride with Zebby.
Could you imagine if the Twins traded Royce Lewis for Nick Anderson? Don't get me wrong. Yeah, I love Nick Anderson.
That's the type of stuff, right? Like, yeah, I mean, yeah. Every ask started with Brooks Lee, right, this year, and Walker Jenkins.
Yeah,
and you're not gonna do that.
Chris Atterbury joining us in the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Chris, last time we talked to you, we talked about Pablo Lopez and some of his struggles. He's starting today for the Twins. In his last 7, 3-2, 39 strikeouts. In his last 15, he's got 91 strikeouts. Have you noticed a change in him? And you talked last time so much about his work ethic. You said nobody works harder to get out of those things and get out of those slumps than Pablo. Do you feel like he's trending the right direction now as the Twins get towards the postseason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's a different guy than the last time we spoke, and the results show it. He's made a minor tweak mechanically, and it's not the type of thing you would notice unless you were really looking for it or somebody tipped you off to it. But his glove hand was low and as his arm stroke came through, and now it's a little higher. And if you go back and look at last year, it was a little higher last year. And just something as minute as that, his command has been a lot better. The action on his pitches has been a lot better. And he also has been very unlucky this year. He's the second. They take your expected results and then your actual results. He's ranked the second unluckiest pitcher of the year in the first half. And that's starting to level out too, which you would think it would by the end of the year. But he's been a horse, man. And he's taken that little tweak and sharpened up his stuff. And he hasn't allowed innings to snowball. And that was always the case in the first half when he'd have a rough start. He'd be really good. He'd rip off 8-9 guys in a row, and then, you know, a 2-out walk would lead to like a 2-3 run inning. And he just couldn't stop the bleeding. And now he's stopping that bleeding, getting a bandage on it, getting back in the dugout, and getting back on the rails. And they need him to, right? That 2 days out of every 5, they need length. They need length from Pablo. They need length from Bailey Ober. Both of those guys know it, but I think both of those guys are up to the task.
Chris, I love our bats, but we've had the ups and downs pitching. Although we've done very well against teams with losing records, just had a really hard time with teams with winning records. So from the postseason perspective, how excited or you know, what should people really expect of the Twins in the postseason?
Well, we got to get there first. So let's do that. let's make sure we get into the postseason. That's one. I think our lineup is much better suited for the postseason than it's ever been. It's just deeper, right? Like, we can beat you more ways. And obviously, in the postseason, you want Byron and Carlos in that lineup. So take the lineup that we're going to see today and throw Byron and Carlos in it. It gets really deep. It can hit velocity. It can hit off-speed. It can hit lefties. It can hit righties. It can hit for power. You can lead the world in doubles. Like, so it's a deep lineup that will grind you down and can beat you in a lot of ways. And we have answers off the bench too. So I really like where the lineup is and its ability to score runs in different ways. The pitching is the big question, and it's everybody's big question. And it's funny because you always hear the same thing, right? You need a big ace, a big stopper for the postseason. You got to have that ace. You got to have that stopper. And everybody wants an ace. Everybody would love to throw Paul Skenes or Tarik Skubal or one of these guys in a postseason start. And obviously Pablo's shown what that can look like. But just having that guy doesn't ensure success. You know, I did a lot of postseason games with Johan Santana where he was starting and the Twins didn't win a series, right? And he was the best starting pitcher in the game. Last year we win in Houston. We've got him right where we wanted. We've seized back home field advantage. We've got Sonny Gray, the Cy Young runner-up on the mound, And he gave up a four spot in the first inning before the crowd had settled into their seats and our season was over. So it's not a guarantee. What you do see in the postseason is creative usage and depth of pitching. Guys who were starters coming out of the bullpen, matching up differently, working backwards. So in that sense, I think we have a lot of tools that really play well in a short series. Duran, Jax, Alcala being the three primary guys now that can cover three innings in a different portions of a game and you feel pretty good about. I do have concerns because we haven't had that one guy come out of the pen who can just get a big lefty, no doubt get a lefty every time. I love Caleb, and he's pitching much, much better right now, but he didn't have a spring training. He's had an inconsistent year. So that's one area where I think the Twins might be lacking a bit. But when you look at the depth of our pitching right now and what that pen could even look like in a postseason series, what if I told you that you were going to get four out of a starter, but then you had Louis Barlin for two innings and then Alcala, Jax, Duran? Would you take that? Oh, you might, right? Like, we saw what Louis can look like in that role. So I do think we're deeper than we've ever been. We've raised our floor. When we have to get deep and go to the minor leagues to pull up a guy to fill in a spot, those guys that we get right now are better than they've ever been in the last decade. And so we've raised our floor. And then if we can get some of the top-end guys back, like Byron and Carlos, I really like the depth. I think that's our superpower. Our superpower as a team this year is our depth and the ability to grind you out and beat you in a lot of ways. And that's kind of what playoff baseball looks like.
That is the voice of Chris Atterbury, radio play-by-play man of the Minnesota Twins, who take on the Texas Rangers this afternoon, 1:35 first pitch. Chris, last one for me, as you look at the schedules from both the Twins and Cleveland, gosh, they both have very similar in terms of opponents, it looks like to me. You know, I think September looks harder for both teams, and they'll play each other one more time. But when you look at these schedules, who truly has the tougher path to the postseason in your mind?
Well, I'll be honest. I think I don't really look at their schedule or ours for that matter, because I can barely figure out where I am today. But the one thing I do know is that everybody's pretty good, right? Like, you can't say, look at the White Sox just shut out the Yankees. So it's like you can't say, oh, that's a win, that's a win, that's a win. The only team left on our schedule, there's two of them that are really truly out of it, are probably, Miami and the Angels. Yep. And even the Angels have a guy who throws like 104 in their bullpen, you know? So I don't think there's any easy path anywhere. It comes down to, I would say, our path is harder because we have to catch them. And they have the tiebreakers. So they're two games up on us, but really they're three. We get the games there, which are big. But September's going to be a grind for both teams. And I think it's going to be a similar grind in that there's no off days really for either club. And the pitching, you know, it's all about the bullpen management for both of these teams. And if you're playing every day, you're not getting a lot of breaks, you're not getting a lot of blowouts, because that's what we're seeing. Neither the Twins or the Guardians are playing a lot of those blowout games where your big bullpen dudes can rest. We saw Clause throw four games in a row last week, and it's still August. So I think it's going to be a grind. The Royals have the healthiest rotation, but the Royals have the worst offense. So they're still very much in play. Boston's still very much in play. You know, it's going to be a grind for both teams. I feel like we are a playoff team, and so I feel like we are ready to accept and lean into that grind. But every series is a test. We go to San Diego next. They might be playing as well as anybody in the league right now. Even though I don't think the three of us combined can name two of their relievers, they got the best bullpen in the league right now. So it's a matter of, we better win in Cleveland in late September and just make sure we're in a position where those games matter. If those games matter, and that road trip is Cleveland-Boston, who's fighting right for a wild card too, if those games matter, the penultimate week in September, then we're in shape to do something, control our own fate, then that's all you can really ask for.
Chris, I got one last real quick question, and I know we're really long, but I have to ask you this one. Being a Stanford guy, John Lynch with the 49ers right now, Hall of Famer, Stanford, he's got Trent Williams, Brandon Ayuk, he's got to get those guys signed, and then he's going to have Brock Purdy. How's he going to get that done?
Well, if anybody can do it, it's probably John. So he was a senior my freshman year, and he had played baseball at Stanford too. You know, people forget. He actually started the first game in the history of the Marlins franchise. He was the starting pitcher of their, rookie league game, and his hat's in the Baseball Hall of Fame because of that. But John Lynch, my freshman year, they went on the road to Notre Dame, and he broke Lake Dawson's ribs on a crossing route, and then he jarred one loose from Bettis, and we won, and it was a big deal. So I saw him when the Super Bowl was in Minneapolis. I went to the party out at Paisley Park, and I saw John there. I was with another buddy from Stanford, and we walked up to him, and we're like, Mr. Lynch? And he's like, hi. And I'm like, when you broke Lake Dawson's ribs, it was the best moment of our freshman year. Then we just had a great time the rest of the night. It was awesome. Going down memory lane. So I would like to think he can figure it out if anybody can. Let's be honest, the 49ers have some history there, don't they, of kind of being creative with their payroll, mm-hmm. going back to the 80s a little bit, maybe paying the piper later on. But I think I would put a lot of faith in John to figure things out. He's a great guy and a really sharp guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Atterbury, thanks so much, man. I have to tell you, I've thoroughly enjoyed this season listening to you behind the microphone. You've done an excellent job, and I always appreciate you giving us some time on a Sunday morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, I appreciate it. Pretty easy for me. I sit next to Paul Molitor for 9 innings today. How hard is that, right?
That's like
some people would win in an auction, and I get to actually do it. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, buddy, that's great. Chris, thanks so much. Enjoy the game today. Again, Twins at 1:35 today, first pitch. So we're taking it to 12:30 today. Mm-hmm. Coming up next, we will take a quick break, come back, talk a little NIL. What does it mean for the NCAA, this new ruling that's going on in court right now? We'll talk about that coming up next. Whenever we have Josh on, I try to make sure you get at least one Marconi entry for weather.
Yeah.
So I just did it for you.
That was awesome.
Everybody gets an 80. Everybody gets an 80. So very interesting stuff coming out right now in this House versus the NCAA class action lawsuit. Essentially, what this settlement is proposing is some restrictions on NIL. And basically, the headliner here is that what the deal is has to reflect the athlete's, quote, fair market value, the definition of a valid business purpose related to the promotion or endorsement of goods or services provided for the general public for profit. To police it, the NCAA would set up a third-party clearinghouse, which would require every Division I athlete to submit potential NIL deals that are more than $600 for approval. I read this today after you had talked about it, Pete, and I literally screamed at my computer. I said, this is all well and good. This really is a brilliant way to monitor NIL. But why the heck didn't we do this before? Why wouldn't you come up with these guardrails ahead of time? Because it's impossible to put Pandora back in the box now.
It's incredible. We talked about it right out of the gate, though. We've been on this saying, hey, look, what are the parameters? What limits can be there? And trying to figure things out that would be fair but also make sense, right? I mean, I think that was something that we've talked about. Anytime we've ever brought up NIL, we've talked about exactly that. I got some really weird stats for you, Dave, when it comes to NIL. So let's do this first one. Over one half of the NIL deals are valued at $100 or less. Now, how many people know that? How about this? The median value, when all is sorted out from the least to the greatest, is $62. Okay. The average value is $2,716. I bring all this up because of the fact that we always hear about these huge ones. And I've got a big one for you right here. The Texas mm-hmm. Longhorns, right? In June, they went out and they offered Dia Bell, who is coming out of high school. He graduates in 2026, by the way. Texas Longhorns offered him $9.2 million in his NIL deal, $2 million signing bonus when he signs
That's
up
insane.
For them.
That's
and,
insane.
And an annual number of 1.6 million. I mean, where are we going?
Where getting this money? It's just so interesting that again, we've talked about this. Not surprising that this got way out of control in an immediate hurry. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the kid from Texas who showed up and there were like 7 Lamborghinis in the parking lot and he got to pick one. It's so dirty and it just makes me want to take a bath. You know, like it's just How are you going to pay an 18-year-old kid $9.2 million to play football for your school? And how are you going – and this to this point, I think this would clear this up. How would you be able to provide evidence to a third-party clearinghouse that a young man who's 18 years old who's played high school football is worth $9.2 million in fair market value?
Yeah.
There's no way to do that.
No.
You just can't. And I think for that reason, there's no way that they're going to be able to get this through because you are limiting what these kids are going to be able to monetize themselves for. Mm-hmm. James Clausen, who's co-founder of the Tennessee NIL Collective and the Volunteer Club, said, quote, I'm reading from Front Office Sports, quote, the NCAA is again restricting an athlete's ability to fully monetize himself. I think that's just going to open up more lawsuits. He's not wrong.
No.
And it's not the kid's fault that right. these schools and that the NCAA said, all right, let's just open this up. Everybody run. Go ahead. Without putting guardrails on it. And now they're going, oh, whoops, we really messed up. We got to fix this up. Once again, this proves to me that the NCAA is arguably the stupidest governing body out there. That they're trying, not only are they trying to do this now, but they're trying to do it after they've already made the NIL legal.
It's crazy, Dave. You know, there is some numbers out there too where they want to do the revenue share of roughly somewhere between $20 and $22 million a year, right? And most athletic departments in football is like 70-75% of the revenue, but that still puts you at 12.5 to 15 million as your NIL essentially. I mean, it's your, you know, share of your revenue. It's these numbers are crazy, and it's amazing how they have just sort of sat back, let this go, try to see what happens, and now trying to figure out how do we fix it? Can we put it back in Pandora's box? We can't. And that's going to be one of the big issues as well. So it's just crazy. You know, and to your point, Dave, I think that when you look back at the NCAA, and we've always known this, or at least we've known it for many, many years, that they seem to make mistakes at almost every turn. And I can even tell you, I sued the NCAA back in my freshman year in 1981 because I played one play yeah. of a game, and that counted as an entire year. So I got my year back. But why would I have to have done that? How did that make sense in the first place? The NCAA, they're wrong in just about everything that they do. And that's the part that makes it so frustrating is they just don't seem to have a handle on it. And they've opened this thing up that they can't close. And it's going to be a difficult thing to process for a really, really long time.
And part of the problem here, Pete, is that there's no foresight with this governing body, right? Oh. I mean, they basically had no choice but to start to allow NIL or they were going to lose all the best players in college sports. And so rather than take some time and go, okay, let's think about how this is going to play out, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, a 15-year plan, how is this going to go as we move forward? Instead of just going, all right, it's Wild West, go ahead and find all your deals. You know, go ahead, much money as you want, take $9 million from Tennessee and a Lamborghini from Texas and a Lamborghini from there too, but that lack of foresight and that lack of planning is what's the bigger problem here. The NIL is not the problem. It's how they governed and policed it. This lawsuit and these restrictions that they want to do is not the problem. It's the timing in which it's coming out, mm-hmm. and I just. They have got to figure out a better way and not be playing from behind, so to speak. That's what they're doing. They're entering every game down 6 runs mm-hmm. and looking for a 6-run home run. They're not there. You can't do it. And so this they have – they're making these huge mistakes at the wrong times. Mm-hmm. And small changes could change this. Again, we've said this the whole time. Is NIL out of control? Yes. Is it the worst idea in the world? No, it's not the worst idea in the world. The players, you know, they make a lot of money for these college institutions. I'm not against them getting their fair cut. I am against the guy coming in to Tennessee as an 18-year-old kid, or Texas. I'm looking at Tennessee on the screen, so I keep saying it. Yeah. a kid coming in for Texas making $9.2 million before he's ever even set foot on the field to go to college for free. It's just... The timing of this and the lack of foresight is what really grinds my gears.
Yeah, it's a frustration. There's no doubt about it. And the mistakes that they have made, it was almost better in the past when it was dirty to do it than it is. This is dirtier than the dirty. I remember, and this goes way, way, way back, but in 1985, we were playing the University of Oklahoma. They hadn't played a game yet. We'd played two games. We were going to play them in the Dome. And so they allowed our coaches to go down there and scout them on their practice field. And the coaches came back and they said, you should see the parking lot. So that was 83 or 85 rather. So that was pre-NIL for sure. There was no NIL back then, but there was a little bit of cheating going on. But nonetheless, nothing like what we're seeing. That actually seemed more fair than what we're looking at right now. This is out of hand. And we've been calling it out and calling it out, but I think they're finally realizing that it is out of hand, and yet it's a very difficult thing to fix right away.
We're getting some text here to thestylesfinancial.com talking text line 651-461-9226 on this new case that is this new lawsuit that is coming up now, and they're trying to argue about House versus the NCAA. We'll get to those next because there's one here that I want us to kind of both weigh in on, Pete, but we're up against the break. So let's take a quick break, come back. We'll talk more about NIL. You're listening to The Huddle on 830-WCCO. Great song. We're having a spirited conversation about the NIL and how the NCAA is trying to put Pandora back in the box. We've got some text to thestylesfinancial.com talking text line 651-461-9226. One texter says, it's hard seeing athletes choose their school based off of financial reasons instead of intellectual reasons. Mm-hmm. Don't disagree with that, right? Sure. I mean, that's – but
it's been going on forever.
Here, yeah, exactly. That's been happening for a long, long time. Yeah. They athletes, for the most part, are not choosing their school based on academic reputation.
Right.
Right. If that was the case, why would anyone ever choose Oklahoma? Josh, I'm just kidding. That was just a shot at Josh.
Who stop?
Oklahoma.
That was a good one, too.
Oklahoma's a fine institution.
They'll win a national championship before the Gophers ever even come close to touching it. So let's calm down.
But will they make a bowl game based on their academic prowess like the Gophers did? Huh?
Yeah.
Huh?
It's all academics at Oklahoma. Let me tell you, those test scores are higher than Minnesota ever could touch. So,
another texter says, I disagree with your guys' takes on NIL. We live in a free market society. If a kid can make millions of dollars doing something, then let him or her do it. If coaches or ADs don't need guardrails for the money they make, why should the kids? So I'll be clear here that I have no problem with the kids are trying to get as much money as they can. The problem here is that this, to me, Pete, is that the school shouldn't be able to offer that much money to a kid coming out of school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming out of high school, rather.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of a misinterpretation of what we were really saying, which is, you know, and also how about the fairness of two or three players maybe making seven figures and the other, mm-hmm. the rest of them, they're contributing, right? I mean, we have gone so far from everybody's got the scholarship, you know, and that's great. You've got some guys that are walk-ons and everything else. Fantastic. But I don't know. I think the disparity is unbelievable. And that's what bothers me probably to some degree.
And I've said this 100 times. Once again, these kids are getting a free college education. Okay. Yeah. We lose that they're getting a free college education diploma. The other problem I have with this, and I've said this many, many times, you have a men's basketball player and a women's basketball player doing the exact same sport with the exact same practice schedule, with the exact same restrictions on their schedules and their lives. And the male player is going to make more in NIL than the female player. That is not fair. That is not equitable. And that is a major problem with this NIL, the way it's going, to me. That's my humble opinion for what that's worth.
I agree.
We're up against it. We'll take a quick break. We're coming back. You get a bonus half hour of me and Pete today.
Giddy
before
up.
Inside Twins takes over at 12:30. Giddy up. We'll be right back.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Alo, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Preseason game number 2 of 3 for the Minnesota Vikings in the book. Another win. But this week is not without its difficulties, Pete. J.J. McCarthy injury, a meniscus tear. He has to get it repaired. He gets it a complete fix, so he will miss the end of the rest of this season, miss the entire season, then hopefully be back next year. We talked a little bit about this off-air, but I think Matthew Collar, in my mind, put it best of J.J. McCarthy gave Kevin O'Connell the button to push. Right. If the Sam Darnold experience is not what they hope it is, that he has that button to push in the first preseason game of what we saw of J.J. McCarthy. And it was one preseason game against a Raiders team that, as we discussed, was terrible against the pass last year. However, he did exactly what you hoped that he would do, which is play very well and rebound from, things like an interception. Come out of the second half and play well. There was consistency there in his game, I think. And so everyone was very, very excited. In my mind, though, the fact that he's – and when it happened this week, when they came out and said the meniscus was torn and he was probably going to miss the season, and in my mind, other than the practice reps he was going to get, I don't know how much this necessarily hurts J.J. McCarthy's development as a quarterback and or changes how much he was truly going to play in the Vikings offense. However, yes, he's not going to get those reps. He's still going to be there. He's still going to get to learn in the film room. He's still going to absorb it all. And I think more than anything, J.J. McCarthy is going to come back very, very hungry and ready to go. And I think next year will be a phenomenal year for him. It does not bother me that he's not going to be on the field this year. I know it bothers other people. It just doesn't bother me that much because in my mind, I hope that Sam Darnold will play well enough to keep him on the sideline and learn and come out next year and be super, super hungry and ready to go.
Dave, it bothers me, but there's nothing we can do about it, right? I mean, it bothers me only because the progress that I have watched since he first got drafted by the Vikings to where he was getting to and what he looked like a guy like we've talked about. The moment's not too big. And it makes sense, actually, because let's go back to we all know his record. His record as a high school player and a college player is just off the charts. But his Michigan performances were pretty stellar, right? I mean, across the board. It was never too big. And that's what I like so much about what he brought to the table for the Vikings. You know, the problem, and I always joke about this, as you know, about the USC quarterbacks, right? And I always say, name me a good USC quarterback. And I got it in front of me right here. Sam Darnold, 63 touchdowns, 56 interceptions. He's gone 8-10, and he's had one winning season, and that was with the Jets when he won 7, lost 6 as the starting quarterback. That's kind of the blueprint of what you see out of Matt Leinart, Sam Darnold, Matt Barkley, Mark Sanchez, John David Booty, who got drafted, didn't even play, was a practice squad guy. Sanchez has more interceptions than touchdowns. So does Barkley. So does Matt Leinart. you start going
list.
Through.
you go For through, such a great school to have that list of failed quarterbacks.
Right. And you know what it is? And it's not me being overly critical about USC, but I think you can be critical about this, which is, hey, look, USC is great. They did a great job all these years going all the way back to the 70s and 80s, right? When they have had so many great teams. But the problem is, how do you know how good the quarterback is? And it shows me that oftentimes the quarterback was not the best player. He gets all the notoriety, he gets all the press, everything. But when you look at what these guys do at the next level, at the NFL level, suddenly you say, well, Maybe it was the fact that they had three guys on the offensive line that were first round draft picks.
Yeah.
And maybe a running back, probably a quarterback or a wide receiver or a tight end. Those teams were so loaded, whether it was Marcus Allen or whoever the running backs were, they had more guys that got Heisman trophies there than you can shake a stick at. And some of them were quarterbacks, but the reality was, did they even deserve them in college because of the players that they were surrounded by? You know, that's, I would put a lot of those Alabama quarterbacks in this same sort of a category. They've had a little more success, but not a lot, not all of them. So it's one of those things where, you know, how do you determine if they're as good as you expected them to be at the next level? Because the next level is different. And I do think when we look at this, I was curious, what did you think about the idea? You heard about the rumors and all the rest of the Tom Brady's talk and all of that.
Oh, my gosh. What is he, 47 now?
He's 47 years old. But here's the crazy part, Dave. He has kept himself in that position where people sort of wonder. He kind of sounds like maybe he's not done, right? He has given that. To the press and everybody. I'm not saying he's gonna, but you know, JJ's a Michigan guy. Maybe Tom Brady's a Michigan guy. I mean, was there a possibility? Maybe we signed Matt Corral from the UFL, Ole Miss quarterback, but I'm not sure that's Tom Brady, right? So,
well, it's the whole like when Brett Favre, you know, when they signed Brett Favre for years, it was like, oh, they're gonna sign Brett Favre. They're gonna sign Brett Favre. I don't even know if they can afford it now, considering they just gave, you know, we talked about the Stephon Gilmore signing, gave him $10 million, number one. Number two, my guess is the reason that he's still kind of, you know, these little tidbits come out here and there. Part of it was from Colin Cowherd, who is a FS1 host, and Tom Brady is going to do football for Fox, right? I mean, you know this, Pete. It's the PR machine to keep things going. Do I want a 47-year-old Tom Brady quarterbacking the Vikings? No. Is he better than Sam Darnold? Probably.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. Probably. He probably is.
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to go with yes right now.
but there's, to me, at 47 years old, there's no way that guy makes it through the season without getting injured. There's just none. But I will say this, and I fully recognize this, and I am curious if our listeners feel the same way. The 651-461-9226. It's the stylesfinancial.com talk and text line. I am fully aware that in my mind, and in terms of Viking quarterbacks, I am afraid to love again. I get it. And I have a very strong feeling that there's a lot of people out there who feel the same way. I want to fall head over heels in love with J.J. McCarthy. I absolutely do. But I have before with Tavares Jackson, with Teddy Bridgewater, with Christian Ponder. So many first round quarterback picks that were like, yep, this is the guy who's going to be next. This is the guy who's going to be next. And they never were. Yeah. And I don't want my heart to be broken again. So that's why I keep saying I don't want to see J.J. McCarthy yet, because I want him to be ready for this stage, both physically and mentally. Mentally, 100%. He is there, Pete. You're right. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that this injury will do nothing to his mental state. He will come back stronger than ever. The kid is a winner. The kid knows how to push himself, and he has since he was a young age by all accounts.
Yeah.
But physically, the game speeds up. The hits are harder. The D-backs are faster. And it takes time to adjust. And I just don't want to see it. I didn't want to see him go out too early that he wasn't going to succeed, because I need this. Our hearts have been broken so many times. We need to finally have that franchise quarterback. I have been in Minnesota on and off since 2002. Been here since 2007, my second stint. What franchise quarterback have they had? I mean, Kirk Cousins, maybe, but everyone knows he couldn't win in the postseason and when the stage was the biggest. We need this guy, and we so badly need J.J. McCarthy to be him that I'm just not ready to put myself out there yet and get on the dating sites and be like, okay, I'm ready to do it. I'm just not there yet. I just don't want to have my heart broken.
So here's where I've got one question for you as far as quarterbacks, because I have an opinion. I don't know what your thoughts would be. Would there ever been a time that you would have considered Ryan Tannehill? And I understand he's had his ups and his downs, but overall, when you really look at his career, the guy's 64% completion. He's got 216 touchdowns, 115 interceptions, which basically is not bad at all. Good winning record. He's got experience in the postseason. He's always had a great running back, you know, with the big fellow back there. So what do you think? Would that have been a direction that you would have? I guess the better question would be this. Do you go for the corner to try to get things, you know, taken care of on the defensive side? Mm-hmm. Or do you worry more about the quarterback and you go for a guy like Ryan Tannehill? Could probably have afforded him. I would bet you. He's no one signed him. So I think the reality is you could probably get him for something very close to the Stephon Gilmore sort of a contract. I don't know.
Yeah, I think from their standpoint, they have bought in to Sam Darnold, right? I mean, they have no choice now. They have nothing. They can't go back and say, well, we signed Sam Darnold, but now since our rookie quarterback, who probably wasn't going to start the season, is out, let's go get another high-priced quarterback. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that works on a lot of levels. It's not that I don't think Tannehill could play, and if he's an improvement over Sam Darnold. I mean, you and I were both last year like, how did the Vikings not get in on Joe Flacco, who comes in and plays great for Cleveland? Mm-hmm. You know, instead they get the Pastrnak, who was good for a couple games, and then he's gone. So do I think that he would have been just as good, if not better, than Sam Darnold? Probably, but I also think that in because of the time that they're at, they have no choice but to stick with Darnold now, because you know as well as I do, Pete, that sometimes it's about egos with general managers and coaches, right? Like, they have to justify it, and Matt Collar touched on this with Lewis Cine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to justify what you've done. And there's no way in my mind that they could say, well, you know what? We swung and missed on Sam Darnold, even though he hasn't played a game yet. Or maybe what you're saying is they should have taken him over Sam Darnold. I don't know what the financials would have been. I think, to me, they're one and the same. The one thing I'll say about Darnold, and we've talked a lot about him extensively, the one thing he hasn't had in his career, and I know we got a break, is Kevin O'Connell. And I think, for my money, if there's ever been a quarterback whisperer in the NFL, it's Kevin O'Connell. And I think, now what's his ceiling? I don't know. But I think Kevin O'Connell can bring the best out of Sam Darnold. Is that good enough? We'll find out. But I think Kevin O'Connell does.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll turn our sights to the Twins. Chris Atterbury joins us coming up next. We'll talk about the Twins' chances in this last month and change of the season. You're listening to The Huddle on 830 WCCO. Chris Atterbury, the radio play-by-play voice for the Minnesota Twins, joins us now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Chris, good morning. I have not had a chance to chat with you since the start of Zebby Matthews this week. And from what I'm reading and what I saw, by all accounts, he was real impressive. What was your close-up view of how he handled himself and how he pitched?
Zebby Mania. Let's get on with it. He played. and it was his comportment. I think you hit how he handled it. I think that was the key. And I think that's something that we're starting to see now be endemic to the Twins player development system, that when the guys are called upon, and we've had to call upon a lot of them, they're ready mentally as well as physically. He's a really big, strong dude, and you look at him, and he's just a big block of a man. And he's got this short, quick arm stroke, and I don't think you could tell if he would have been up 10 runs, down 10 runs. He was just steady as the day is long, and he's going to have every opportunity to pitch here down the stretch, and I was impressed. And the stuff is really, really good. I mean, he just throws a ton of strikes, and if you come in and you start your first major league game and you don't walk a batter, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Chris, out of curiosity, what was your stance as far as the trade deadline? A lot of people were disappointed that we didn't do more. Were you one of those people, or do you think that we've got what it takes to get some sort of distance into the postseason?
Well, I definitely wanted to add. You always want to add pieces that can help, but I also had looked under the hood enough to know that there weren't really a lot of great options. I think the best starting pitchers were in the division. I loved Eric Fetty, but there was no way the White Sox were going to let Eric Fetty go to a team in the division. I always tell people this story. It was several years ago, and the Twins were trying to add an arm, and Nick Anderson, who's a native Minnesotan, was with Miami, and they were going nowhere. And the Twins called and said, we'd love to get Nick Anderson back. And they said, sure, give us Byron Buxton. And they said, no, well, give us Royce Lewis. No. And then a day later, they traded Nick Anderson for like Ryan Stanek and a bag of baseballs to Tampa Bay. Like they had no problem just giving him to Tampa Bay, but with us, that wasn't going to happen. So things are weird at the trade deadline. And, you know, case in point, we're facing Tyler Mowry today for the Rangers, you know, and Twins fans might have a little, you know, trade deadline PTSD with Tyler Mowry's name because we gave up a ton to the Reds to get him and he was going to help, or maybe that was an offseason deal. He made so many deals with the Reds and it just didn't work out, right? He was hurt and he didn't get to pitch, and we watched Spencer Steer and Encarnacion Strand take off. And, you know, think about the trade deadline deal for Jorge Lopez, and they get Yennier Cano, who becomes an all-star, and Cade Povich started for the Orioles yesterday. And so it can cut both ways. We've made big swings and we've missed. And sometimes the best swing is taking a pitch. And I think that in this case, that's probably, I guess I'd rather ride with Zebby and some of the guys coming out of our system than overpay for something that I didn't think was going to move the needle. And once Carota went to Houston for the haul that they got, I mean, Houston paid through the nose for him, for a guy who I don't really think moves the needle. I think the prices went through the roof. And I think, I'd rather ride with Zebby.
Could you imagine if the Twins traded Royce Lewis for Nick Anderson? Don't get me wrong. Yeah, I love Nick Anderson.
That's the type of stuff, right? Like, yeah, I mean, yeah. Every ask started with Brooks Lee, right, this year, and Walker Jenkins.
Yeah.
And you're not going to do that.
Chris Atterbury joining us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Chris, last time we talked to you, we talked about Pablo Lopez and some of his struggles. He's starting today for the Twins. In his last 7, 3-2, 39 strikeouts. In his last 15, he's got 91 strikeouts. Have you noticed a change in him? And you talked last time so much about his work ethic. You said nobody works harder to get out of those things and get out of those slumps than Pablo. Do you feel like he's trending the right direction now as the Twins get towards the postseason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's a different guy than the last time we spoke, and the results show it. He's made a minor tweak mechanically, and it's not the type of thing you would notice unless you were really looking for it or somebody tipped you off to it. But his glove hand was low and as his arm stroke came through, and now it's a little higher. And if you go back and look at last year, it was a little higher last year. And just something as minute as that, his command has been a lot better. The action on his pitches has been a lot better. And he also has been very unlucky this year. He's the second. They take your expected results and then your actual results. He's ranked the second unluckiest pitcher of the year in the first half. And that's starting to level out too, which you would think it would by the end of the year. But he's been a horse, man. And he's taken that little tweak and sharpened up his stuff. And he hasn't allowed innings to snowball. And that was always the case in the first half when he'd have a rough start. He'd be really good. He'd rip off 8-9 guys in a row, and then, you know, a 2-out walk would lead to like a 2-3 run inning. And he just couldn't stop the bleeding. And now he's stopping that bleeding, getting a bandage on it, getting back in the dugout, and getting back on the rails. And they need him to, right? That 2 days out of every 5, they need length. They need length from Pablo. They need length from Bailey Ober. Both of those guys know it, but I think both of those guys are up to the task.
Chris, I love our bats, but we've had the ups and downs pitching. Although we've done very well against teams with losing records, just had a really hard time with teams with winning records. So from the postseason perspective, how excited or you know, what should people really expect of the Twins in the postseason?
Well, we got to get there first. So let's do that. let's make sure we get into the postseason. That's one. I think our lineup is much better suited for the postseason than it's ever been. It's just deeper, right? Like we can beat you more ways. And obviously in the postseason, you want Byron and Carlos in that lineup. So take the lineup that we're going to see today and throw Byron and Carlos in it. It gets really deep. It can hit velocity. It can hit off speed. It can hit lefties. It can hit righties. It can hit for power. You can lead the world in doubles. Like, so it's a deep lineup that will grind you down and can beat you in a lot of ways. And we have answers off the bench too. So I really like where the lineup is and its ability to score runs in different ways. The pitching is a big question, and it's everybody's big question. And it's funny because you always hear the same thing, right? You need a big ace, a big stopper for the postseason. You got to have that ace. You got to have that stopper. And everybody wants an ace. Everybody would love to throw Paul Skeens or Tarik Skubal or one of these guys in a postseason start. And obviously Pablo's shown what that can look like. But just having that guy doesn't ensure success. You know, I did a lot of postseason games with Johan Santana where he was starting and the Twins didn't win a series, right? And he was the best starting pitcher in the game. Last year, we win in Houston. We've got him right where we wanted. We've seized back home field advantage. We've got Sonny Gray, the Cy Young runner-up on the mound, and he gave up a four spot in the first inning before the crowd had settled into their seats and our season was over. So it's not a guarantee. What you do see in the postseason is creative usage and depth of pitching. Guys who were starters coming out of the bullpen, matching up differently, working backwards. So in that sense, I think we have a lot of tools that really play well in a short series, Duran, Jax, Alcala being the three primary guys now that can cover three innings in a different portions of a game and you feel pretty good about. I do have concerns because we haven't had that one guy come out of the pen who can just get a big lefty, no doubt get a lefty every time. I love Caleb, and he's pitching much, much better right now, but he didn't have a spring training. He's had an inconsistent year. So that's one area where I think the Twins might be lacking a bit. But when you look at the depth of our pitching right now and what that pen could even look like in a postseason series, what if I told you that you were going to get four out of a starter, but then you had Louis Barlin for two innings and then Alcala, Jax, Duran? Would you take that? Well, you might, right? Like we saw what Louis can look like in that role. So I do think we're deeper than we've ever been. We've raised our floor. When we have to get deep and go to the minor leagues to pull up a guy to fill in a spot, those guys that we get right now are better than they've ever been in the last decade. And so we've raised our floor, and then if we can get some of the top-end guys back like Byron and Carlos, I really like the depth. I think that's our superpower. Our superpower as a team this year is our depth and the ability to grind you out and beat you in a lot of ways, and that's kind of what playoff baseball looks like.
That is the voice of Chris Atterbury, radio play-by-play man of the Minnesota Twins, who take on the Texas Rangers this afternoon, 1:35 first pitch. Chris, as you last one for me, as you look at these schedules from both the Twins and Cleveland, gosh, they both have very similar in terms of opponents, it looks like to me. You know, I think September looks harder for both teams, and they'll play each other one more time. But when you look at these schedules, who truly has the tougher path to the postseason in your mind?
Well, I'll be honest. I think I don't really look at their schedule or ours for that matter, because I can barely figure out where I am today. But the one thing I do know is that everybody's pretty good, right? Like, you can't say, look at the White Sox just shut out the Yankees. So it's like you can't say, oh, that's a win, that's a win, that's a win. The only team left on our schedule, there's two of them that are really truly out of it, are probably, Miami and the Angels. Yeah. And even the Angels have a guy who throws like 104 in their bullpen, you know? So I don't think there's any easy path anywhere. It comes down to, I would say, our path is harder because we have to catch them. And they have the tiebreakers. So they're two games up on us, but really they're three. We get the games there, which are big. But September's going to be a grind for both teams. And I think it's going to be a similar grind in that there's no off days really for either club. And the pitching, you know, it's all about the bullpen management for both of these teams. And if you're playing every day, you're not getting a lot of breaks, you're not getting a lot of blowouts, because that's what we're seeing. Neither the Twins or the Guardians are playing a lot of those blowout games where your big bullpen dudes can rest. We saw Clause throw four games in a row last week, and it's still August. So I think it's going to be a grind. The Royals have the healthiest rotation, but the Royals have the worst offense. So they're still very much in play. Boston's still very much in play. You know, it's going to be a grind for both teams. I feel like we are a playoff team, and so I feel like we are ready to accept and lean into that grind. But every series is a test. We go to San Diego next. They might be playing as well as anybody in the league right now. Even though I don't think the three of us combined could name two of their relievers, they got the best bullpen in the league right now. So it's a matter of we better win in Cleveland in late September and just make sure we're in a position where those games matter. If those games matter, and that road trip is Cleveland-Boston, who's fighting right for a wild card too, if those games matter, the penultimate week in September, then we're in shape to do something, control our own fate, then that's all you can really ask for.
Chris, I got one last real quick question, and I know we're really long, but I have to ask you this one. Being a Stanford guy, John Lynch with the 49ers right now, Hall of Famer, Stanford. He's got Trent Williams, Brandon Ayuk. He's got to get those guys signed, and then he's going to have Brock Purdy. How's he going to get that done?
Well, if anybody can do it, it's probably John. So he was a senior my freshman year, and he had played baseball at Stanford too. You know, people forget. He actually started the first game in the history of the Marlins franchise. He was the starting pitcher of their, like, rookie league game, and his hat's in the Baseball Hall of Fame because of that. But John Lynch, my freshman year, they went on the road to Notre Dame, and he broke Lake Dawson's ribs on a crossing route, and then he jarred one loose from Bettis, and we won, and it was a big deal. So I saw him when the Super Bowl was in Minneapolis. I went to the party out at Paisley Park, and I saw John there. I was with another buddy from Stanford, and we walked up to him, and we're like, Mr. Lynch? And he's like, hi. And I'm like, when you broke Lake Dawson's ribs, it was the best moment of our freshman year. Then we just had a great time the rest of the night. It was awesome. Going down memory lane. So I would like to think he can figure it out if anybody can. Let's be honest, the 49ers have some history there, don't they, of kind of being creative with their payroll, going back to the 80s a little bit, maybe paying the piper later on. But I think I would put a lot of faith in John to figure things out. He's a great guy and a really sharp guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Atterbury, thanks so much, man. I have to tell you, I've thoroughly enjoyed this season listening to you behind the microphone. You've done an excellent job, and I always appreciate you giving us some time on a Sunday morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, I appreciate it. Pretty easy for me. I sit next to Paul Molitor for 9 innings today. How hard is that, right?
That's like
some people would win in an auction, and I get to actually do it. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, buddy, that's great. Chris, thanks so much. Enjoy the game today. Again, Twins at 1:35 today, first pitch. So we're taking it to 12:30 today. Mm-hmm. Coming up next, we will take a quick break, come back, talk a little NIL. What does it mean for the NCAA, this new ruling that's going on in court right now? We'll talk about that coming up next. Whenever we have Josh on, I try to make sure you get at least one Marconi entry for weather.
Yeah.
So I just did it for you.
That was awesome.
Everybody gets an 80. Everybody gets an 80. So very interesting stuff coming out right now in this House versus the NCAA class action lawsuit. Essentially, what this settlement is proposing is some restrictions on NIL. And basically, the headliner here is that what the deal is has to reflect the athlete's, quote, fair market value, the definition of a valid business purpose related to the promotion or endorsement of goods or services provided for the general public for profit. To police it, the NCAA would set up a third-party clearinghouse, which would require every Division I athlete to submit potential NIL deals that are more than $600 for approval. I read this today after you had talked about it, Pete, and I screamed. I literally screamed at my computer. I said, this is all well and good. This really is a brilliant way to monitor NIL. But why the heck didn't we do this before? Why wouldn't you come up with these guardrails ahead of time? Because it's impossible to put Pandora back in the box now.
It's incredible. We talked about it right out of the gate, though. We've been on this saying, hey, look, what are the parameters? What limits can be there? And trying to figure things out that would be fair, but also make sense, right? I mean, I think that was something that we've talked about. Anytime we've ever brought up NIL, we've talked about exactly that. I got some really weird stats for you, Dave, when it comes to NIL. So let's do this first one. Over one half of the NIL deals are valued at $100 or less. Now, how many people know that? Mm-hmm. How about this? The median value, when all is sorted out from the least to the greatest, is $62. Okay. The average value is $2,716. I bring all this up because of the fact that we always hear about these huge ones. And I've got a big one for you right here. The Texas Longhorns, right? In June, they went out and they offered Dia Bell, who is coming out of high school. He graduates in 2026, by the way. Texas Longhorns offered him $9.2 million in his NIL deal, $2 million signing bonus when he signs
That's
up
insane.
For them.
That's insane.
And an annual number of $1.6 million. I mean, where are we going?
This money. Yeah. I mean, it's just so interesting that I mean, and again, we've talked about this. Not surprising that this got way out of control in an immediate hurry. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the kid from Texas who showed – Texas again, who showed up and there were like seven Lamborghinis in the parking lot and he got to pick one. I mean, it's just – it's so dirty and it just makes me want to take a bath. You know, like it's just – how are you going to pay an 18-year-old kid $9.2 million to play football for your school? And how are you – and this – to this point – I think this would clear this up. How would you be able to provide evidence to a third-party clearinghouse that a young man who's 18 years old, who's played high school football, is worth $9.2 million in fair market value?
Yeah.
There's no way to do that.
No.
You just can't. And I think for that reason, there's no way that they're going to be able to get this through, because you are limiting what these kids are going to be able to monetize themselves for. Mm-hmm. James Clausen, who's co-founder of the Tennessee NIL Collective and the Volunteer Club, said, quote, I'm reading from Front Office Sports, quote, the NCAA is again restricting an athlete's ability to fully monetize himself. I think that's just going to open up more lawsuits. He's not wrong.
No.
And it's not the kid's fault that these schools and that the NCAA said, all right, let's just open this up. Everybody run. Go ahead. Without putting guardrails on it. And now they're going, well, whoops, we really messed up. We got to fix this up. Once again, this proves to me that the NCAA is arguably the stupidest governing body out there. That they're trying – not only are they trying to do this now, but they're trying to do it after they've already made the NIL legal.
It's crazy, Dave. You know, there is some numbers out there too where they want to do the revenue share of roughly somewhere between $20 and $22 million a year, right? And most athletic departments in football is like 70-75% of the revenue, but that still puts you at $12.5 to $15 million as your NIL essentially. I mean, it's your, you know, share of your revenue. It's these numbers are crazy, and it's amazing how they have just sort of sat back, let this go, try to see what happens, and now trying to figure out how do we fix it? Can we put it back in Pandora's box? We can't. And that's going to be one of the big issues as well. So it's just crazy. You know, and to your point, Dave, I think that when you look back at the NCAA, and we've always known this, or at least we've known it for many, many years, that they seem to make mistakes at almost every turn. And I can even tell you, I sued the NCAA back in my freshman year in 1981 because I played one play of a game, and that counted as an entire year. So I got my year back. You know, why would I have to have done that? How did that make sense in the first place? The NCAA, they're wrong in just about everything that they do. And that's the part that makes it so frustrating, is they just don't seem to have a handle on it. And they've opened this thing up that they can't close. And it's going to be a difficult thing to process for a really, really long time.
And part of the problem here, Pete, is that there's no foresight with this governing body, right? Oh. I mean, they basically had no choice but to start to allow NIL, or they were going to lose all the best players in college sports. And so rather than take some time and go, okay, let's think about how this is going to play out, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, a 15-year plan, how is this going to go as we move forward, instead of just going, all right, it's Wild West, go ahead and find all your deals. You know, go ahead, much money as you want, take $9 million from Tennessee and a Lamborghini from Texas and a Lamborghini from there too. But that lack of foresight and that lack of planning is what's the bigger problem here. The NIL is not the problem. It's how they governed and policed it. This lawsuit and these restrictions that they want to do is not the problem. It's the timing in which it's coming out. Mm-hmm. They have got to figure out a better way and not be playing from behind, so to speak. That's what they're doing. They're entering every game down 6 runs and looking for a 6-run home run. They're not there. You can't do it. And so they're making these huge mistakes at the wrong times. Mm-hmm. And small changes could change this. Again, we've said this the whole time. Is NIL out of control? Yes. Is it the worst idea in the world? No, it's not the worst idea in the world. Players, you know, they make a lot of money for these college institutions. I'm not against them getting their fair cut. I am against the guy coming in to Tennessee as an 18-year-old kid, or Texas. I'm looking at Tennessee on the screen, so I keep saying it. Yeah. A kid coming in for Texas making $9.2 million before he's ever even set foot on the field to go to college for free. It's just the timing of this and the lack of foresight is what really grinds my gears.
Yeah, it's a frustration. There's no doubt about it. And the mistakes that they have made, it was almost better in the past when it was dirty to do it than it is. This is dirtier than the dirty. I remember, and this goes way, way back, but in 1985, we were playing the University of Oklahoma. They hadn't played a game yet. We'd played two games. We were going to play them in the dome. And so they allowed our coaches to go down there and scout them on their practice field. And the coaches came back and they said, you should see the parking lot. So that was 83 or 85 rather. So that was pre-NIL for sure. There was no NIL back then, but there was a little bit of cheating going on. But nonetheless, nothing like what we're seeing. That actually seemed more fair than what we're looking at right now. This is out of hand. And we've been calling it out and calling it out, but I think they're finally realizing that it is out of hand, and yet it's a very difficult thing to fix right away.
We're getting some text here to the stylesfinancial.com talking text line 651-461-9226 on this new case that is this new lawsuit that is coming up now, and they're trying to argue about House versus the NCAA. Mm-hmm. We'll get to those next because there's one here that I want us to kind of both weigh in on, Pete, but we're up against the break. So let's take a quick break, come back. We'll talk more about NIL. You're listening to The Huddle on 830-WCCO. Great song. We're having a spirited conversation about the NIL and how the NCAA is trying to put Pandora back in the box. We've got some text to the stylesfinancial.com talking text line, 651-461-9226. One texter says, it's hard seeing athletes choose their school based off of financial reasons instead of intellectual reasons. Mm-hmm. Don't disagree with that, right? I mean,
it's been going on forever.
Here, yeah, exactly. That's been happening for a long, long time. Yeah. They athletes, for the most part, are not choosing their school based on academic reputation.
Right.
Right. If that was the case, why would anyone ever choose Oklahoma? Josh, I'm just kidding. That was just a shot at Josh.
Can we stop?
Oklahoma's
that was a good one, too.
Oklahoma's a fine institution.
They'll win a national championship before the Gophers ever even come close to touching it. So let's calm down.
But will they make a bowl game based on their academic prowess like the Gophers did? Huh?
Yeah.
Huh?
It's all academics at Oklahoma. Let me tell you, those test scores are higher than Minnesota ever could touch. So,
another texter says, I disagree with your guys' takes on NIL. We live in a free market society. If a kid can make millions of dollars doing something, then let him or her do it. If coaches or ADs don't need guardrails for the money they make, why should the kids? So I'll be clear here that I have no problem with the kids are trying to get as much money as they can. The problem here is that this, to me, Pete, is that the school shouldn't be able to offer that much money to a kid coming out of school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming out of high school, rather.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of a misinterpretation of what we were really saying, which is, you know, and also how about the fairness of two or three players maybe making seven figures and the other, the rest of them, they're contributing, right? I mean, we have gone so far from everybody's got the scholarship, you know, and that's great. You've got some guys that are walk-ons and everything else. Fantastic. But I don't know. I think the disparity is unbelievable. And that's what bothers me probably to some degree.
And I've said this 100 times. Once again, these kids are getting a free college education. Okay. Yeah. We lose that they're getting a free college education and diploma. The other problem I have with this, and I've said this many, many times, you have a men's basketball player and a women's basketball player doing the exact same sport with the exact same practice schedule, with the exact same restrictions on their schedules and their lives. And the male player is going to make more in NIL than the female player. That is not fair. That is not equitable. And that is a major problem with this NIL, the way it's going, to me. That's my humble opinion for what that's worth.
I agree.
We're up against it. We'll take a quick break. We're coming back. You get a bonus half hour of me and Pete today.
Giddy
before
up.
Inside Twins takes over at 12:30. Giddy up. We'll be right back.